Welcome to Do You See What I See, a podcast about how people get on the same page and stay there, unless they shouldn't. Today my guest is Tom Oates. Tom is a friend and fellow consultant, a manager who cares a lot about the culture he creates for and with his team. Tom, there's a lot of implications there for what we talk about. I see what you mean, getting on the same page. So let's jump in. You and I work together. You've got an interesting background in news and sports.
Yeah, I'm originally a recovering sportscaster, and now I find myself, you know, deputy director of a government project that surrounds child welfare.
I see the connection. I
only see it when I turn around and look back and go, "How did I get here anyway?"
Exactly.
But, you know. Right? Yeah. Your path only looks clear from behind.
When you're in the rearview mirror. There's some interesting variations there on the theme of leadership, leading, management, being a manager, and getting people on the same page for different reasons, for different purposes. So what are you doing these days that requires you to get people on the same page?
Being as transparent as possible, right? And we hear that a lot, but a lot of it is really trying to create leaders out of everybody, out of your team, you know, in the idea of training your successor, or what happens when I hit the lottery, or as a common friend of ours would say, hit by a beer truck. Mm-hmm. The idea of this is you'd love for, you know, I think
it'll be right now. I mean, you manage a team right now, right?
I manage a series of teams.
Instead of team.
So
okay.
I'm at the deputy director of a project level that has about, when it comes to full-time equivalent staff, about 90.
Okay.
Right. And so, you know, you find yourself not leading the folks that do the work, but leading the folks who manage the teams and leading their managers who do the work. So you're high up on the org chart.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you're high up on the knowledge of what's going on the day-to-day.
But I wanted to situate that when you talked about transparency. You're talking about There's 90 people looking up a team structure, a program mm-hmm. structure.
Yeah.
Teams, projects, up a program structure to where you and the director are. So the transparency you talk about is, you know, on a decent-sized scale there.
Yeah, and it's really transparency up and transparency down.
Right.
Right? Because to create that environment, really what you're talking about is creating trust and creating knowledge. And I don't like the phrase, but it's used a lot of, you know, creating empowerment, right? But part of that is really getting a sense of having your team understand and really kind of value their purpose as opposed to I'm going to do what I'm told versus my voice matters. And having that kind of psychological safety to build that leadership to eventually you're making better decisions, because they're not made by the idiot on top who granted is the one on top and I'm, you know, the buck stops here and blah, blah, blah. But let's be honest, I don't know what's going on in the day to day.
Right.
And so why should
that's
I?
That's a national program
decisions?
Too, right?
National in terms of a
scale.
Oh, in terms of what we do, yeah. I mean, it's a national clearinghouse supporting child welfare workers.
So when you say don't know what's going on in the ground, that ground's in a lot of places.
Well, no, what I mean by our teams.
Yeah.
So what's being written on a day-to-day basis, what's going out in terms of marketing, what are the decisions on the plans are to the next. So really, as a distributor of information, if somebody asks me on a day-to-day basis, hey, what web page is being updated today?
Yeah.
Or what inquiries do we get today?
You can't know.
I know who knows.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But you're right. Yeah, so it comes to, you know, having a wider vision, but not having the depth of what's going on the day-to-day.
Say more about trust and knowledge, especially with the concept of same page. And tell me why you don't like empowerment. I think I know what you mean, but tell me more about that.
Yeah. Well, first, why I don't like empowerment, because if I empower you, that's kind of like saying I've been knighted by the king.
Mm-hmm.
The king still has the power. So because of me, I give you the power. well, then who's really got the power in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to really it's really emancipating somebody from having to always be really micromanaged,
mm-hmm.
or having somebody feel like they always need to be told what to do,
mm-hmm.
right? As opposed to me saying, hey, I'm on vacation, so eeny, meeny, miny, Caroline's in charge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like now I've just given the power to somebody, as opposed to everybody's sort of emancipated to be free in their thinking and planning, knowing that if we are transparent with each other in our communication and our intentions and the reasoning behind it, then ideally it's a team that's always growing, always communicating with each other and reinforcing their own decisions and actions. And I'm here to help do what you're supposed to do at this level of provide overarching guidance.
So you got some structure and process there with getting on the same page kind of baked in.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea is, how do you get on the same page with somebody? Right? And the first thing I think as a leader, as a boss, is you have to make it clear that I value the staff's viewpoint, opinion, expertise, and knowledge. So I kind of have to start first, being vulnerable and saying, I'm curious, being vulnerable and saying, I'm not sure, teach me about this. And so then I'm really kind of already starting to give that power, you know, or value the employee, so to
right.
speak, and demonstrate my value of, hey, teach me, you know, tell me what I'm missing. And this is where somebody can dive into their own expertise.
Yeah.
And so then when I need to get a question of like, well, how would we do this best? Or here's an issue at hand, you know, what are you thinking? I'm going to get some better insight, because now somebody doesn't feel like I've come in knocking on their door and saying, what are you doing? Because I'm checking up on you. It's more like,
a classic.
How does this all get done? Right? You know?
Let's back up a half step there, because I know you, and I don't think you personally feel, you use the word vulnerable. I don't think you feel vulnerable asking those questions. I know you. I know people who could feel vulnerable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a vulnerability. In the classic organizational management theory, higher up you went in the org chart, you were supposed to know more, I guess, until you got
exactly.
to the top.
Exactly. I'm supposed to know everybody's job that I manage,
yeah.
right?
And so if you didn't, if you looked like you didn't, maybe you could look bad. You could look uninformed. You could look, oh, what kind of leader is this? But
yeah.
That's been flipped around over a lot of years now to what you're talking about, which is, if you got 90 people working for you, you got 90 people who you have to clear stuff out of the way so they can get their jobs done well. So they bring, what you said a second ago, their knowledge, subject matter expertise to something.
Yeah, that's exactly how I define my job, as I'm knocking out the barriers to let the smart people do what they do.
Right there, I think that creates trust. If they see the boss trying to clear the brush from their path so they can get the job done, they're like, wow, this is cool.
That's the goal. That's the goal. I mean, that creates an environment of I know that he's got my back, and that they're going to take my opinions or my guidance or my thoughts seriously. In fact, if they come to me for that, if my supervisor comes to me for that, then I'm being listened to. And even if we screw up, you know, he's going to be the one to get, you know, get the hairdryer treatment, right? Get blown in the face. And I will, you know, it's always about my representation of my teams up the chain versus me getting on a pedestal and pointing down and saying, here's what, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Though at times, if you have to set up parameters of, hey, we've got a deadline.
Right.
Or it must have this and this and this. You tell me how we do everything else.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, and then just let them go. That's the idea.
A commander's intent kind of concept. Yeah.
You know, you just use the word, the intent.
Yeah.
You'd love for someone to say, you know, my goal is really to get people away from tell me what to do.
Right.
So here's what I intend to do and why. because it means they're addressing problems. They're coming to me with the with the solution. And if they are, if they're at a point where they're saying why, that means they thought about the questions I know I'm already going to ask. And therefore, they've put my hat on.
Yeah.
And said, you know, here are the things that somebody else may be thinking about. Yeah. Or the end client says this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it sounds fatalistic, you know, train your successor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm about to go on 2 weeks vacation and everybody knows already what to do.
Right.
You know?
Well, you painted a pretty clear picture of how you get folks on the same page who work for you. Let's break that down a little bit. You've got some kind of leadership team between you and everybody in the front lines. So how do you work that, the same principles with that smaller number of people? I don't know, 6, 8, 10. And then how do you see them getting on the same page with one another?
You know, it's the same thing when you're talking with the entire team of turning the intent over to them, you know. Here's a perfect example. Issue comes up or a problem comes up, right? And we have a meeting to discuss this. The first thing I'll do is, you know, hopefully everybody understands the problem, or at least if they do, I'm going to communicate that. And then I shut up. Because if we walk in and say, hey, here's the situation, the client just needs this, this, and this, I'm thinking we do A, right, we do B, and then we do C.
Right.
I have taken any idea that somebody walked into that meeting with and they're just deflated it.
Yeah, right.
Because here's what the boss said.
Right.
And now everyone looks at the boss, and now the meeting has changed from what do we do to how do we do what the boss asked.
Yeah.
You know, and so by me shutting up or opening up and going, and my favorite phrase is, what am I missing?
Yeah.
You know, tell me what the gaps are. Tell me what you see. And that just opens up everybody to be free with their comments and their thoughts and objectives. Okay, what does that look like? And again, what am I missing? Giving everybody a chance to really tell me, as opposed to like point fingers at each other. They get to tell me, or you treat the issue as something separate that's like in the middle of the table. So nobody's taking it personally.
Yeah.
About getting on the same page. And I think having a piece of ownership in that is a big part of it, because it gets to like, I am creating a solution and I'm doing my part.
And that ownership comes from, I think I know the answer, but tell me where that ownership comes from. We hear that. Where's that ownership come from? How do you get that to happen with them?
You give it. You know, we're in a situation where we're still under a corporate America where the factory floor is the factory floor, and the guy up in the office wearing the white collared shirt is the one that makes all the decisions. I mean, that's how our organization chart worked. But we're really in this, you know, we're really in this knowledge workforce.
Yeah.
So I have to you have to break the supervisor or supervisee, you know, factory model. And now it's in terms of everybody's got a role. You know, my role may be, you know, I really look at myself as more of the backseat navigator, right? You know, in an airline, you've got your pilots and your co-pilots, and you've got that guy in the back who's the navigator, who is at least saying, hey, by the way, we want to make sure we go from New York to LA. And right now it looks like we're on path to go to Vancouver, you know, and the pilot's like, okay, well, then I'll just do X, Y, and Z, you know, and, all right, sounds good. We course corrected. Or to really say, hey, it sounds like we're going to Vancouver. And the pilot can turn to you and go, yeah, we just left the airport.
Right.
I still have to turn west.
Yeah, right.
You know, so to get back to the idea of ownership, you know, I'm shaking my head. It's like, where did it come from? It's like this buzzword that rolls around. But it's really who takes the accountability, responsibility, who has the decision-making power, right, so to speak, right? Or who's in the best position to lead the work, to direct what's done, and for everybody else to respect that.
If you call on people to do to contribute what they contribute well, there's an investment that they have in the proceedings, in the discussion, in the task of the project. And if you invite that and you support that, so it's not just rhetoric.
Yeah.
That plays out into the meeting's over, people are going to do what they said they would do. So if people can bring their knowledge, experience, subject matter expertise to the table in a conversation, and they know that you're inviting it, you want it, then they feel a motivation. I think people feel a motivation to lean in, to contribute, to pitch in.
To also, it's like improv. It's yes and.
Right.
Because they will build, they'll not only say, hey, they'll also come back and go, I thought about this again.
Right.
And we can do more.
Right.
Or somebody else is adding to it. And they feel like, you know, you walk away and you're like, well, the meeting was really theirs.
Right.
You know, if somebody was to look at the transcript, I just kind of welcomed folks in and let them build. And $10, whatever I came in with, my A, B, or C, they have added every other letter in the alphabet. And if we just went with my idea, it would not have been as innovative. It would not have been as creative.
Complete,
it would not
robust,
have been as engaging.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's certainly the case that someone in your position has a view up the chain of command that others won't have. You have knowledge of a view up the chain. And part of what you're saying is that you're going to pass that down appropriately to your team.
Where you can.
But you can't have a view of all of the work that each of them has, because they're working with the members of their teams who are really doing the work on the front lines. So we're talking about a picture here of quite a bit of collegiality, which is what's hoped for. How have you dealt with differences constructive? So within that collegiality, differences are going to come up, and that's you hope so, because otherwise you could have some groupthink going on, or you could have some blind spots that everyone's just letting, you're just rolling on, and people are missing some things, and no one's stopped to question them. How do you foster? How do you lead them? I'm still thinking of your management team through those conversations where there's some differences, and you want it sorted out in an honest way.
Sure, yeah, because you could easily, you know, everything could look good to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then, let's say amongst that like group of 5 or 10, that there's somebody who's really usurping it because they're the one that talks all the time, mm-hmm. and they have just a dominating mm-hmm. personality, and you don't know that or something to that nature. I think the best way are still having those individual check-ins too, right? To have that kind of deeper conversation, to where you're able to just turn to each individual and be like, what do you need? You know, what's working well? Mm-hmm. What's not working well? What am I missing?
Mm-hmm.
And if you've established that trust, that hopefully they look at those one-on-ones as not a report out to me of all the things that I'm doing,
right.
but it's their ability to vent to me, you know, and let me know what's bothering and what they don't have enough of. And it's okay at that point for their problems to be my problems, or at least for me to be aware of those problems. Doesn't mean I have to solve them. But this is where the coaching comes in. This is where you're able to coach people in terms of breaking down those conflicts, working with each other. Because the last thing, what ruins the intent-based, that whole relationship, the whole understanding, is running to tell mom or dad.
Mm-hmm.
And having mom or dad then run in and mm-hmm. say, well,
here's what we're gonna do.
You don't have dessert, and you go to your room with no internet for an hour, you know, because then that tells them that's how I solve problems.
Yeah,
by going up the chain and crying, and then it's like whoever comes to my office the most seems to get all their problems solved, because that's no, we can't have that then, and no triangulation, right?
Yeah.
And so if it comes to that, I mean, if you have to have the hard conversations, you bring them together and you separate people from the issue,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, here are the facts. This happened, this happened, this happened. talk to me about what went on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talk to me about what you mentioned earlier. I'm already covering sportscaster at a Coast game, and if football team loses, the last thing I'm going to do, and you know, of course, Lou knows I'm about 5'8", 155 pounds. I am not walking into the 6'5", 300, you know, biscuit away from, you know, linebacker, and saying, "So how come you guys stunk today?
How'd you miss that tackle?
How come you didn't play hard enough?"
Right.
Instead, you separate yourself. Hey, in the fourth quarter, they racked up 152 yards on you guys. What was the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like I'm pointing to a third party in the room, and it's the incident. And that's an easier way just to have tough conversations. And I know I drifted a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point, though.
But it is kind of like when you do talk about getting people on the same page, separating the issue and putting it out, let's say, on a separate page. So I haven't put your names associated to this. I've talked about, all right, folks, this happened and this happened and this happened. So walk me through that thing,
mm-hmm.
Not you got to do this better and you got to do that better. Now, you know. Now shake hands and don't fight again. You know,
in interest-based negotiation, right? Which Roger Fisher and Bill Urey developed in the 80s, long time ago. Separating the people from the problem is the first principle.
Because really, it's our problem.
And you know, Deming talked about that in TQM back in the 70s, after studying the Japanese, who were kicking America's ass at the time with auto production.
Yeah,
because of the environment that they created in the factory.
Yep,
that was quality. That somebody,
anybody had the ability to go stop.
Right, yeah. Right. So separating the people from the problem is a great technique for of a number of things, but one of them is difficult conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you had a situation where? Someone, you didn't see a positive response to the approach that, so you and I are talking about a general or a broad approach to leadership.
Yeah.
And we could talk about the difference between leadership and management, but it isn't like that's not known. You might have a particular take on that, but that's out there in a lot of literature. If someone doesn't take quickly or warmly or, you know, enthusiastically, they need a little time to respond to even this approach of transparency, of trust. Yeah. So they don't want to get on that page yet. How do you handle that?
Well, I'll give you a kind of a perfect example. I was in a discussion. It was a leadership forum amongst some of the middle managers, and the topic of that session really dealt with decision making and control. You know, the undercurrent being how not to be a micromanager, right? And so one of the things that was kind of posed to the group is, you know, why do you micromanage? And all the answers were what you expect.
Yeah.
You know, control and getting it done right and, you know, protecting people. Okay. And then the follow-up is, you know, what are the impacts? And you got a differing opinion from you're suppressing people and you're causing distrust, all that too. Well, I still see kind of a need for this. And it was, you know, the whole thing is based out of wanting to get it right, though rarely is anybody in a field. I mean, this is why when you go to the hospital, everybody who talks to you asks you your name, because they want to make sure if they've got medication for Lou that they're actually
goes
giving
in
it
Lou,
to
Lou, right?
Right.
Right.
But most fields, mistakes aren't always super, super critical or can't be backed away,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, but we treat them like they are. Mm-hmm. We're afraid to fail. And that fear is what's driving things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could sense that in people who were a little bit more reluctant to be, nope, I need to look over the shoulder of everybody who's doing work,
mm-hmm.
you know, because either it's my ass on the line,
right.
or I just want to make sure it's done right. But you could see folks kind of struggling with the real rationale, which was, I'm afraid they won't do it right. And then it's bad. And then, you know, that's bad on me. And it's, you know, we've got stuff to do. And so, you know, and I'm going down this rabbit hole, basically saying, you know, you got to be transparent and open and vulnerable with yourself on this. And so the fear behind that. So you're asking, what happens at that point if someone's not there? You may not get the answers you would like.
Well, you touched on something. You said something that I want to come back to. I think it's central. We talked about before. We've talked about leading oneself. So let's just say, as a manager, project lead, whatever a role of some authority is, where work's being done under your, you are accountable for what comes out of some work
effort. The client just comes to you first for everything. Something like that.
And you if you're worried that something won't get done right, which is the motivation to micromanage, that's just, so step back to that, just that point. You're worried something won't get done right. Your worry could be valid, or you could have legitimate reason to, or not. And maybe you don't know. Maybe you've not even thought about that. You're just the type that's going to worry and micromanage. It's possible to go to someone and say, Tom, we're going to kick off next week, and you got this part. I've got some concerns I want to talk to you about. So now, this is where you're leading yourself. This is where you're making, you're holding yourself accountable for what you want others to do. I gotta fess up. I gotta open up and say, I'm worried about X because of Y. You're new to the team. You just got your certification. Whatever the reason is.
Yeah.
If it's, I don't like you, you got a different issue to deal with. That's something else. And if you don't like somebody, you have to deal with that in an honest way with yourself, because you could prejudice the work. And
absolutely.
Okay. But apart from that, if there's reasons that you could articulate why I'm worried, it could be a fair discussion to have with somebody.
Absolutely.
And you could negotiate a way through it. Like, so, cause you could put some controls in place that are agreeable. I don't want to micromanage you, but can we talk more often? Initially, can we talk every couple of days about how things are going?
Sure.
Or could you tell me, if you're struggling with something, could you just kind of raise your hand, like in the, you know, online, raise your hand and say, hey, I got, let's go over something. There could be some ways through that that are good for the relationship. That's important. Good for the work, right?
Yeah.
Could build trust instead of trashing it. But this comes back to something you've said, we've talked about before. If you can't do that for yourself, you can't do that with them.
Yeah.
If you can't be honest with yourself, you can't be vulnerable with somebody else. Because that is a bit of a position of vulnerability to say, I'm a little worried about something. Can we talk about it and see if we can come to agree a way through it? Because you don't know how that's going to go.
And frankly, as you brought that question up, that question can come from a client, that can come from your staff.
That's right.
Like, you know, your boss could say this to you. Somebody else, let's say I'm a project lead and the other project lead also says that about me, could come from your staff to you.
Right.
No matter what, there's that like, all right, let's see where we can understand our strengths and weaknesses. And I'm perfectly, and I think it helps to stress that, right? To say, hey, listen, I totally see it. And then negotiate your, you know, what's a better way for me to develop this? And if it is, I'm going to give you a weekly status report, or we'll do a just touch base every week, or I'll tell you what I'm going to, you know, do. We'll tag up, whatever it is. Here's the thing where I think about developing trust is, whatever we come up with, do it.
You got to abide by it.
Do what you say you're going to do when you do it.
Yeah.
That alone builds trust of, I can count on every Thursday I'm going to get this in my inbox, and Thursday by 9 o'clock, bing, gosh darn it, there he is again.
Yeah, that predictability is important.
Yeah.
That predictability.
And so that's an aspect of managing trust, but I think that's an aspect of anything. So if I'm going to, you know, do the same thing with a teammate, you know, if I'm going to do the same thing with the direct report, be like, hey, you know, this part's completely yours to innovate. Just, what, you know, here are our deadlines. You know, I'm clearly not going to walk away from anything. Well, but you establish how that looks. You build it with them.
Yeah, you
That's
do.
The thing.
Yeah, you do.
You know?
Yeah, you do.
You build it with them.
So, because something could come back to you, and they could say to you, hey, look, can you do something for me? Can you let me know how you think I'm doing? Can you give me some positive feedback? Yeah. And they could have requests of you that you wouldn't have thought of. And like, well, hell yeah, I'll do that. Of course I'll do that.
Yeah.
You just touched on something that's really important. In a good conversation, one characteristic of a good conversation, whether it's one-to-one or the team, it has an emergent property. Something comes out of it that wasn't planned, wasn't mechanical, couldn't have been predicted, emerges from the interaction of people.
Yeah.
Right? So fresh ideas can come out of that. Solutions to problems can come out of that. Something innovative could.
Yeah.
And maybe something that helps people connect, right?
It doesn't become, we've all been in the meetings. Heck, I think you and I will probably, anybody who's listening to this, we're in one today where the meeting is just somebody reporting out.
The report out is deadly.
Something I could have read already,
yeah.
Right?
The report out is deadly.
Or something I could have recorded. You know, now that all our meetings are on like Zoom or Microsoft Teams, I should have just recorded it and sent it to you. It's, you know,
just deadly.
It's like from Airplane. I just hit autopilot. The guy pops up and just, you know, reports and walks away.
I didn't drop many classes in college, but I dropped one because the professor read his lecture notes to the class. And it was so deadly. It was just so deadly. So even if the information was good, the delivery was so uninspired.
It's a one-way street.
And it is. And he's not even looking at you while he's reading.
Yeah, right.
And so you don't even have the feeling of, hey, professor, I got a question. Right. And there could be some engagement. It was just deadly. And the report outs are that way. The report outs are just mind-numbingly deadly. And they don't engender any interaction, really. They may maybe a Q&A. Hey, could you clarify?
And normally that's somebody saying, okay, your thing now affects me. So
I want to know more about it.
I now want to have a one-on-one conversation with you in this group setting. That's even better. But to get to your point, when you build it if you really are talking about building something with somebody, literally,
yeah,
you're getting on the same page.
That's right. You're creating it.
You know, yeah, exactly.
You're creating it.
In fact, that's
a really important point because we're all only on our own pages. There's nowhere else we can be. Yeah. We can broaden and deepen that as much as possible, but still we've got limits to what, that's just, it's a human.
And it's not me putting a page in front of you and saying, do you agree?
No.
It's one we built together. Yes. So literally there's no other page for us as opposed to here's my idea. But I need your feedback. What do you think of my idea?
Yeah, right.
And
right.
It's like, you know, I've just walked in and been like, here's the page. You know, this is the manager walking in saying we're going to do A, B, and C. This is me walking in, dropping a piece of paper and saying, okay, folks, here's our page. How do you all agree to get on my page?
Right. Well, and
right? As opposed to like, you people are all smart. What should we be doing?
And
here?
sometimes, you know, even the phrase "getting on the same page" can cause someone to have a reaction of, "Oh, that means I got to get on someone else's page." That could be explicit thought. That could be an intuition. Oh, I got to get off my page and onto someone else's page.
And this is that
leadership. Or at least leave some of mine behind.
Right, exactly. It's going back to that old hierarchy model.
Yeah.
Of how do I get on the boss's page and how much of my soul is going to get crushed by it, right?
Yeah.
You know, I may have these ideas, but here's what this knucklehead wants. Or maybe I can influence his page a bit to have something of it, right?
Yeah. That's just it feels different than if you're really genuinely engaged in creating something that you're all creating together.
Yeah, it's like when you ask, so right now, to diving in a little bit about the human service field, and especially within child welfare, there is a push to really stress incorporating those with lived experience, right? Because you have a lot of people who may not have had exposure to the foster care system making decisions. They decided in college they wanted to change the world. They got their MSW and they went out there to save kids. God love them. But their perspective is different than the families that they're serving, their understanding, their background. Okay, so now finally child welfare is getting into the sense of we really need to incorporate their voice to help develop policies that really suit their needs. Great. Well, how do we do that? And the process of policy development goes on. And then there's some point where they ask somebody's opinion. What do you think? You know, and we hear from their stories and, oh, okay, great, thanks. And then we keep moving on. So it's like you gave somebody the microphone and then they walked away, but we haven't incorporated anything, right?
Yeah, right.
Where is it a point where now if you really do it right, they're there at the table at the beginning giving perspective. They're there at the review stages and they're there at the approval stages. That's weaving somebody in as opposed to just hearing somebody. So when I walk into that meeting or when we attack an issue, I walk in with my page and I ask you what you think, which is really, you got to do this or not.
Right.
You know,
right.
As opposed to, all right, let's build this page together.
Yeah.
Because you know, and then there's the breaking the mold of the boss is going to tell us what to do.
There's different vantage points that different parties have. So if you've lived in the child welfare system, if you supervised, if you managed something about it at that frontline level, all the way up to the top of the chain of command where somebody, let's say it's a government program, so someone has got to be accountable to OMB or Congress.
Right.
That's a valuable role and perspective too. But we get top heavy with it. We lose sight of the fact that, you know, there's literature about bureaucracy and unintended consequences of national policy is massive. It's a library full of literature, and it comes not only but in part from not really knowing what's going to happen when the rubber meets the road. In fact, there was a policy development process or method that came out of that decades ago called backward mapping, where you started with an articulation of what was supposed to happen where the rubber met the road, where that policy is implemented in a community or in a housing development, right, where it happens.
Right.
And if you looked at what behaviors the policy was intended to change down there, you could quickly see if it had a chance or not, or you could see what would enable or what would constrain the change you're trying to bring about. But you had to look at it from that granular level first, because then if you got it right at that level, even just conceptually, I don't mean an actual program. If you just got it right conceptually, you could back up. This is the backward mapping. You could go to where policy usually starts, which is at the top of an organization.
Right.
And then you could look at, well, what are the things that are going to enable or constrain what we need to do at the ground level? It was just trying to flip it around and get a different perspective on it.
It's one of the things that I think if you're working with, let's say you're in a what somebody would call a skip meeting. So I'm not meeting with my direct report who manages a team. I'm meeting with one of the team members.
Yeah.
Right. And so they're walking in and, oh, this is so-and-so's boss's boss. But if you turn around and say, hey, here's this issue that happened, or even better, here's the problem at hand. What would we need to solve this? What would the environment look like?
Right.
And they'd say, and they'd give you things that they may think are impossible.
Yeah.
But if my job is really to knock that stuff out of the way, it's like, no, this is what I want to know. Affect.
Right.
This is what I can affect. Right. And so getting that input changes things from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I look at it and be like, well, clearly either they're not doing something right, or they've got the wrong information, or they're just not equipped to do whatever it is. And they may turn to me and say, no, if
that's
the
not
problem
it. Yeah.
Is this is it, and this, and I could do that. In fact, if we had this thing, we could do this, this, and this. And you're like, well, what's stopping us from doing that? And then they look and go, well, I thought we weren't allowed to. I don't
right,
know.
Right,
it's like,
right. No, I can like, I can now, make that
now,
happen.
Now I can help. Now as the manager, I can help.
You I can know, make that happen.
Situations of, hey, that's my job. So I think then they've then developed, you know, if you're talking about getting on the same page. I mean, it's just a continuation of the discussion of intent-based leadership, yeah. Right? How do
that's
you get
though.
People on the same page? How do you get people on the same page is by walking in with a blank one. Right.
Yeah.
And as the leader, you have a position of power that's already bestowed upon you that you need to pull back from. I mean, it's not like your very first, very new hire. They're totally blank to the organization. You think it's a clean slate. They're walking in with kind of this, you know, systemic idea of what my boss is. And you have to break that. You have to break that to be like, nope, you're a part of this. You know, you're awesome. You do what you do. There's a reason I hired you over those folks.
I mean, look, the bottom line is a decision will be made. I can make it. If you leave me to my own devices, I'll have to make it.
Yeah.
If we pull together and come up with some good stuff that no one individual was going to come up with, and perhaps not even a subset of the team, right? When a team works well, there's contributions from each part that produce what emerges, and I'll make the decision to go with those best ideas. So I have the authority, and I would choose to not exercise my authority that way. I'm going to share the authority with this team, meaning I'm still will make the decision. I'm still accountable for it, but I don't want to design the solution. Let's do that as a team.
You know, they've developed this and they've demonstrated their competency and they've demonstrated the ability to pick things apart. And now they've finally felt that they can be trusted to share that.
That's critical.
You know,
yeah, that's critical.
You know, yeah.
I call the show "What I See What You Mean" because of something that you just touched on, which is I did some consulting one time for somebody pretty high up a organizational chart who wanted a team to be more innovative. And I talked to him pretty thoroughly about what that meant to him. But then when I could go down the food chain to where the work was being done, and I could say, hey, the boss wants some things around here to be more innovative. Tell me what do you hear when I say that?
Yeah.
The point was the conversation illuminated. One word means different things to different people, and it's all relevant.
Yeah.
So if innovative to them on the front lines meant they could solve some problems, but innovative to somebody in the CFO shop meant something would save money. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. Who's to say that someone's right or wrong? Sometimes as a consultant or sometimes in the work I've done as a third party, you can see the different vantage points, the different perspectives of different parties. It's always nice when you can bring that together and they can see it for themselves.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's when they can go, oh, I never thought of it that way. That's the emergent property of a good conversation, because then things start to come together and people are having their own aha moments going, all right, now I understand. And just what you said a second ago, even as the manager, when you said, all right, I can take care of that.
Well, because now I see, you know,
exactly.
I see what they mean.
And now
right?
I can contribute. Right.
And that's an idea of taking the perspective, right? Taking the others.
Yeah.
You talked about policy development. Yeah. And it's like, what do I see from the top? Versus what do I see, you know, at the grassroots level? The problem is, and I guess a lot of it is extrapolated really well from things like books like Freakonomics or Science Cynics books, where somebody goes in and looks at the problem from what it is. And it's like, you know, it's not like people are bad drivers. It's you have no stop signs or, you know.
There's some great techniques for things like that. Like, pretend you are you're a data point and you are moving through an information system. It's just a device to make you shift perspective.
Yeah.
If you're going to argue that the world is black with white stripes, and I'm going to argue it's white with black stripes, somebody might ask us to argue the opposite. Then they do that like in a debate school, a debate class.
Yeah.
Argue the opposite. It's not to be facile with the argument or to be deceptive, you know, to be, it's to go, did you ever play chess and turn the chessboard around and in the middle of a game? Makes you see the board differently, and your brain quickly starts to reconfigure. If you're trying to do some problem solving with people, there's lots of techniques like that that are intended to get at what you just said, that perspective shift. The more we can shift perspective or broaden perspective, the more I think sometimes it feels like it might challenge us.
Mm.
But if you're patient and you just sit through it and you realize I don't have to abandon something I believe or something I think I know or I care about. But if I be patient and just sit through this conversation, that's a good conversation, so I don't hold back, let myself engage, I might find out some things that help me better do what I think I was out to do or keep me from making a mistake. Maybe we should try it. Let's try it your way first, because I think if you're right, then I can bring this in. Whereas
it's also where when you're dealing with, you know, like organizational conflict or somebody not, you know, the ball's not moving in the right direction, if we want to just hurl cliches.
Right.
But understanding what's holding somebody else back.
Right.
You know, why are they always so defensive about this or whatever it is? And I think that having that understanding of the other side of the story, or just one of the things, and having a communication background, you know, taught me this really, really early. It's not about what I have to say. It is about what somebody else hears.
Mm-hmm.
And so my goal in the message isn't to, you know, spout my part. It's to connect with them, right? There's plenty of times where I walk in with my idea and then I walk out thinking my idea was so stupid. You know, I'm glad I shut up because they were better. They were better when they combined. And I'm like, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
You know.
All right, brother.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And that's how we see it, my friends. I want to thank Tom for joining me for today's episode. Send questions and suggestions through the app. Subscribe and give me a 5-star rating unless you can't, in which case tell me why. And join me next week when we take another look at how to get on the same page and stay there, unless we shouldn't.